Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
For over 130 years, McCormick has helped you make mom's lasagna to keep her secret recipe alive. Take over taco night, no matter how chaotic your day is. Conquer the bake sale, even if you get to it last minute. And craft the perfect Sunday brunch when it's not even Sunday. Because with McCormick by your side, it's gonna be great.
First degree.
You see it on the news, you see it on the paper, you see it on Facebook.
These things are supposed to happen in movies, not in real life.
It made me real bitter against the world, I guess. It seemed as if ever since that happened, it gave me a sad reality of how cruel the world really is. It was a rude awakening.
Welcome to The First Degree, the true crime podcast that you might end up on. My name is Jack Vanek, and I'm sitting far away from Alexis Linkletter and Billy Jensen. And you know what? I love daylight savings time because we're recording during the day for like the first time in very long, and it feels so nice.
It is nice. I feel quick and fresh.
Very fresh. Billy has his camera set up so weird that all we see is the window and back of him, but I guess...
That's right. I'm trying to keep myself backlit because it's during the day and I normally don't go outside during the day.
Yeah, I also think we're in this weird window where Billy's so low energy because it's like the daytime. He said like three things.
Billy, anyways, he's in his hibernation time before
pick it up a few notches, Billy.
Yeah, Billy, get a little pep in your step. What day is it?
All right, you want to talk about the day? We're going to talk about the day. Today is Wednesday, April 7th. And you know what that means? April 7th is National Beer Day.
That's what's up. Yes, a day I can get behind.
If you could drink one beer for the rest of your life, what beer would you pick?
Spicy Mango Cart.
Ooh. I forgot about mango carts for a second.
The spicy ones are gone. They're really, I don't know if they stopped making them or if it was just a brief time, but I can only find regular mango carts now.
Really? That might have been a limited time thing. Damn, Golden Road, bring back your spicy mango cart. You could drink those beers all day long. And
we need them for summer.
They level each other out because there's a little bit of sweet, a little bit of spice. It's so good. I would also agree. And then, you know, just I could do a Stella if not. Billy, what about you?
Zima. Zima all day, every day.
Zima?
Yeah.
Isn't Zima those like fruity wine coolers?
Clear beer. The clear beer. Yeah. No, it's a beer. It was considered clear beer at the time. No.
It's like a Keystone.
You know what? No, it wasn't exactly like Keystone. But I think, I don't know, what beer would I pick? I don't know. You know what? We drank a lot of Yingling in Pennsylvania, and I do like a Yingling.
Love a Yingling. Yeah.
Yeah.
Just a nice lager.
It's also Public Television Day.
Can you have just left it with Beer Day?
Come on. No.
Like a PBS?
Yes, like PBS. Yeah. I'm sorry if I'm trying to bring a little bit of wholesomeness to the group.
How are you trying to bring wholesomeness to the group?
Okay.
Who's
your favorite public television character or personality, Alexis?
I think it's time to start the show.
come on, Alexis.
I don't know, Billy. I don't watch public television.
Okay.
You didn't watch Sesame Street growing up?
Was that on PBS?
Yes.
Are you sure?
Yeah, I'm sure.
Okay, then Cookie Monster.
Okay. You guys should have seen Alexis's face when she just said that. The disdain.
Wow. Okay. Well, you know, the vibes are really good here, so we're going to jump into the show. So that's enough of that. What, Billy?
Mine's Grover, by the way. All day.
Okay. So let's turn down the lights.
And turn up your anxiety.
Because this could be you. The setting for today's case is Maple Heights, Ohio, which is a suburban neighborhood on the outskirts of Cleveland, and it was named for the copious maple trees that pepper the region.
And today's case takes us back to February of 1979. Do You Think I'm Sexy by Rod Stewart and Gloria Gaynor's I Will Survive were topping the Billboard charts, and Elvis, ABBA the movie, and the Warriors were in theaters.
And today's story starts in the morning of a very cold February day. Here's Laura, our first degree, who was born and raised in Maple Heights.
It was February 21st, so it was winter. And back in the early 70s, we had pretty bad snowstorms all the time.
Laura's nuclear family consisted of her mother, father, and two siblings.
From what I remember from the time it happened was that my dad was working out of town.
Morning turned to evening.
My mom made dinner. We were sitting down, the phone rang.
Laura's mother picked up the phone, and Laura instantly noticed a shift in her body language and demeanor.
And I visually saw my mom just not being upset, but like freaking kind of, like I didn't know what was going on, but she was definitely pacing and anxiety.
Laura was 13 years old in 1979. And she couldn't have known that her mother had actually picked up the phone and received one of those horrifying calls everyone is always afraid of receiving.
We'd asked her what was wrong. She just wouldn't tell us anything.
Time passed, and Laura's mother continued to say nothing.
So I remember her waiting for my dad to come home. As soon as she saw the headlights in the driveway, she beelined out the door, left us there.
So this is confusing. Laura's mother had received a phone call and darted outside when her father came home. Laura and her siblings expected their mother and father to obviously come back inside, but instead, their parents sped away in her father's car. And hours passed.
Laura didn't know what to think, but she could recall one thing that her mom said when she was on that ominous phone call. There was mention of her grandmother, who lived nearby. Laura and the members of her family were extremely close with her 63-year-old grandmother, who was named Elizabeth Jarosak.
My grandma was a pretty strong Hungarian lady, so she was very outspoken. She definitely told it like it was. No bullshitting about anything. She definitely put you in your place, but she was my grandma, so to us kids, she was always loving. She always gave us what we wanted. We always had a lot of fun at her house, played a lot of games, played numerous Yahtzee and rummy games all the time. Coloring, I just remember those types of things. We had a really close family growing up. It was a lot of Sunday dinners that we were always over. So it was our family, my cousins and my aunt and uncle, and then my grandparents. And it was an every Sunday occasion, so we saw them every weekend.
Okay, back to this February 21st evening where Laura is observing this odd sequence of events unfolding in front of her. After hearing her mother mention her grandmother, Elizabeth, on this jarring call, one of the only things that was going through her head was that maybe like something had happened to her grandmother. Maybe she had fallen or gotten ill or gotten hurt or something.
I thought maybe she was in the hospital and they were at my grandma's. So I'm calling my grandma's to speak to my mom and dad. But the police answered the phone.
It's never good when the police answer the phone.
Then, you know, still at like 13, I'm trying to grasp what the deal is, what the hell is going on. And he just said to hang tight, that my parents would be home soon.
Okay, well, to a 13-year-old, these words by a police officer were probably pretty comforting. To Laura, things sounded okay. And like the officer said, her parents would be home soon. Laura and her siblings had no choice but to just hang tight.
I remember talking amongst my brothers, wondering, but not knowing anything. And not knowing anything until they came back.
Then, around 11 p.m., Laura heard their parents' car approaching outside. But oddly enough, when Laura looked outside, she realized that her parents hadn't returned alone.
Right. Laura's parents approached the home with three of Laura's first cousins, 12-year-old Shari, 10-year-old Teresa, and 7-year-old Tom. And Laura walked up to her cousin Teresa.
I am outside with her, and I say to her, "What are you guys doing here?" And she's like, "I have no idea." And I'm like, "What?"
And there were two more members of extended family who had also tagged along.
They have their dog and my grandma's dog.
Cousins and family dogs. So what exactly was this occasion? Once initial greetings were made, Laura's parents brought all of the kids inside, and the mood was strained. It was tense.
That's when my dad and mom sat down and told all six of us what happened. I know where everyone was standing in the kitchen, and it's like I can remember it as clear as day. And I think he was more so talking to my three cousins, you know, because of the way he said it.
Laura's father turned to his two nieces and nephew.
"Your father shot your mother."
Laura's Aunt Kathy had been killed by her Uncle Tom, Kathy's husband.
I just remember everyone, like, it was like pandemonium, like breakdown, crying. My cousin, who's the oldest at the time, she threw a few expletives and, you know, "That motherfucking son of a bitch." You know, and then I just remember us crying and my mom and dad hugging us. And then after that, relatives upon relatives coming to our house all night long.
A moment like this, such horrific news like this, shatters the lives of so many in an instant. So the question here, what the fuck happened? Well, we're going to rewind and tell you.
So Catherine Kathy Jerosak met Thomas Callahan when she was in high school at only 16 years old. Tom was older. He was 19 when the couple began dating. And by the time that Kathy had turned 17, she was pregnant. Following the news of the impending baby, Kathy and Tom ran off to Michigan to get married. They picked the state of Michigan because a signature wouldn't be required for the couple to legally wed there. So that's what they did, and they had this whirlwind wedding. And it's worth mentioning that Kathy's family was not happy about any of this.
Yeah, it's probably no surprise that the shotgun wedding, which excluded both sets of parents, was not the best foot to start this marriage out on. Kathy's parents didn't take to Tom. And this was especially the case with Laura's grandmother, Elizabeth, who, remember, is Kathy's mother.
She did not like him at all. Right. She didn't even want them to get married when they got married, because they ran off and got married.
So even though Elizabeth hated her new son-in-law, life didn't stop for Kathy and Tom Callahan. They continued to build a life together. They had three children in total. And Tom was earning a living as a real estate agent. By the time Kathy was 31, she was also working in addition to caring for their three kids.
She got a job later on at JCPenney, a department store where she worked, you know, just in the customer service department. She was pretty quiet. I always thought she was really pretty, real dark black hair with blue eyes. And I kind of always admired her just because how she was with the kids and stuff, and just how she was when I stayed over there. She was very just sweet and nice.
And here's what Laura remembers about her Uncle Tom, which is a stark contrast to her description of her aunt.
At this point in my life, I think he's a fucking asshole. But at that point in my life, what I consider to be that now would be a show-off. I always thought he was, like, cool. You know, in my mind, I'd be like, who does he think he is? He thinks he's just cool. And he's not. You know, like, kind of, that's the impression I had of him. Very stern, never really cordial or smiley or anything like that. Just kind of, just a loud mouth and stern is how I remember.
Years after Kathy was murdered, Laura heard several stories from her parents. So the wedding of Laura's parents was almost destroyed after Tom flew into a jealous rage when he learned that Kathy was partnered to walk down the aisle with a different man relative in the wedding party. Tom accused this man of coming on to his wife. Words were exchanged. Laura's dad, the groom, had to step in and intervene. And everyone was crying, and there was all of this drama at the wedding. And this kind of controlling, possessive behavior is often brushed off, but it can really be indicative of abuse and a deep-seated dysfunction within a relationship. So Laura's parents had several encounters with Tom over the years where he would demonstrate this narcissistic, dominant personality, and everyone seemed to tolerate him for the sake of just trying to keep the peace, but no one liked him.
My cousin has told me that there were several nights she could hear him slapping her or hitting her, like in the next room, because her room was right next to theirs, and her coming in, laying in bed with her and crying, and then him coming in and saying, "You don't need to lay with her," and like taking her out.
By 1979, Kathy and Tom's marital problems continued to get worse. The arguments continued. And when Kathy began that job at JCPenney is when things got even worse. So once she got that job, the abuse apparently escalated and turned physical. Laura learned that at one point, after Kathy had been hired at JCPenney, management wanted her to model in one of the fashion shows they were having at the store. So Kathy wanted to do it. But when Tom found out, he ended up beating her so she wouldn't be able to be in the show. As we discuss the circumstances between Kathy and Tom, the domestic violence component we're dealing with here is a given. But women can hardly get people in charge to give a shit about domestic violence now in 2021. So imagine the position you'd be in 1979. There were so few resources or people to turn to if you were being beaten by your partner every night.
So during the 70s, domestic violence, for the most part, was largely unrecognized in the legal and medical communities. And it wasn't really socially acknowledged either. Women's shelters just weren't really a thing. And here's an example which demonstrates how much the people in charge gave a damn about women needing resources to escape domestic violence. So looking at 1973 LA, for example, homeless shelters provided 1,000 beds for men. You know how many beds they had for women? 30. By 1979, the Equal Rights Movement had made progress in having the powers that be acknowledge the existence, just the existence of domestic violence in American homes, but there were still scant resources.
And shifting back to our story, it was February of 1979 when it seemed as though Kathy was mustering the strength to leave Tom once and for all. And we asked Laura what prompted Kathy to finally take the leap and divorce Tom.
I think just the unhappy and domestic violence, which at that time wasn't even addressed at all. I've heard from my mom and dad that she would wear long sleeves to work a lot because she had a lot of bruises on her arms and such. The week before it happened, my aunt asked him for a divorce. And she told her best friend at JCPenney the next day that he told her, If I can't have you, nobody's going to have you.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's Mix and Match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Hey, there's no reason to feel sad or guilty about the things you aren't using anymore. Whether it was a fancy dress you wore to a gala, expensive heels that only go with one of your outfits, or that crossbody bag from when you were in your music festival era. Somebody out there wants what you don't. And The Real Real makes it easy to get it to them. When your past becomes their future, everyone wins, especially the planet. For The Real Real, Earth Month isn't just another month. It's what they do every day. At any given moment, they're finding new homes for over 1 million unique items within their community of 35 plus million people. They're the largest luxury reseller in the world and making a tangible difference towards a more sustainable future for fashion. Resale reduces the amount of fashion waste in landfills, lowers greenhouse gas emissions, and offers an alternative to the cycle of consumption propagated by fast fashion. The RealReal has kept over 37 million items in circulation and out of landfills. This month only, new shoppers get 20% off when they shop on therealreal.com using code FIRST. That's therealreal.com using the code FIRST.
Sometimes it takes a different approach to help you unlock your true potential. With Capella University's game-changing FlexPath learning format, you gain relevant skills you can apply to your career right away. Earn your degree from an accredited university and be confident in the quality of your education. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu. Capella University is accredited by the Higher Learning Commission. Learn more at capella.edu/accreditation.
Thirty-four-year-old Tom Callahan had become increasingly violent and abusive towards his 31-year-old wife, Kathy. And by February of 1979, things between the couple had really reached a fever pitch. After years of escalating abuse, Kathy had asked Tom for a divorce. And on February 21st, Tom decided to go to a bar with a friend and drown his sorrows.
From what I understand, they were at a bar or something, like out to lunch and or something like that. And he made the comment something like, I got a gun, I'm going to shoot Kathy. And the friend was like, are you out of your mind?
No, Tom wasn't out of his mind. He knew exactly what he was saying, and he wasn't kidding. Tom and his friend go separate ways after leaving the bar.
He leaves there. He drives to his house. My aunt is home with the three kids. My cousins at the time were 12, 10, and 7. This is what I got from my cousin, the oldest one.
Laura is referring to her cousin Sherry, who was 12 at the time.
She said that he comes in and he tells them to go outside. He wants to talk to their mother. And Sherry, my cousin, was like, where do you want us to go? And he was like, I don't know, go across the street or next door. You know, and she said, neither of them are home. And he was like, well, just go outside. I guess they did as we're told and went outside. They were standing out in the driveway is where they were. In the middle of February, when it's like 17 degrees or whatever, and probably less than that. She says that not too long after, she heard like three pops.
Kathy and Tom's kids stood outside stunned after hearing three loud pops coming from inside their home. Then a car pulled up. The driver was one of Tom's friends.
Next thing they know, his friend, a buddy of his, is coming and picking them up and taking them to his house until my parents got there to get them.
And after the children had been picked up and Tom was left alone inside the house with the wife he had just killed, he picked up the phone.
He called the police on himself. I guess the police came, and as they had him up against the staircase, you know, like cuffing him or whatever, asking where the gun is. At that point in time, he said, I also shot my mother-in-law.
So it turns out that prior to killing his wife, Kathy, Tom, for unknown reasons, had driven over to the home of his mother-in-law, Elizabeth Jarosak. And he killed her first. And remember when Laura had called her grandmother's house before her parents had returned with her cousins in tow? Yeah, well, this explains why the police were at her grandma's house and they answered the phone there.
I don't know where he got a gun. Apparently, after they searched the house, he had a lot of weapons and so forth. From what I understand, he went to my grandma's house first. They lived only a couple blocks away. We think that my grandma was making dinner. She lived alone. My grandpa already had passed several years before. They didn't really lock doors back then either. That's another thing. And being that it was him, he probably just walked in.
Okay, but what motive could Tom possibly have to kill his mother-in-law?
We think that he thought she was butting in on their business, you know, like giving her advice or telling her she needs to divorce him or anything along those lines. We speculate that, you know, he probably just shot her. And then once she was down on the ground, the police say that he shot her in the head, I guess, to make sure she was dead.
Okay, so as far as why he would do this, you know what I mean? Any ideas? Is it just this like rebellion against what he considers like an overbearing presence? Is he blaming the mother-in-law for this gumption that Kathy suddenly has to leave? Like what? It's such an odd move in this case.
I mean, I don't know. It depends on maybe if he was feeling out of control with her leaving him. So that's something that he felt he could take control of himself. I guess I don't know exactly how involved the mom was within their life. So maybe he felt like she was controlling. There's probably so many different aspects of, I don't know why, in his mind, why he could justify what he was doing. But it's very bizarre.
Yeah, well, I mean, the common sort of trope about the mother-in-law being domineering, it seems like that has mostly sort of gone away, but that was a big, big deal back then. Mm-hmm. And I know that my dad did not get along with my grandmother. Absolutely.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Well, it's no doubt that the loss of their grandmother, Elizabeth, was yet another horrific and emotionally heart-wrenching blow. It's one thing to lose an aunt, right? And they have children. So these children have lost their mom, and then they've learned that they've also lost their grandmother. Because two matriarchs now in the same family are just gone, just like that, at the hands of this petulant, possessive man who felt the wife he abused slipping away and gaining independence slowly and having the strength to leave. And Laura's father at this time lost his sister and his mother just like that. So we asked her how he coped through all of this.
I didn't see him cry once. He was very, very stoic. My mom has told me that he did break down in the police station, like when they were told what happened. I don't know that my father really ever had a mourning period, to be honest. Even to this day, when I talk to him about it, he'll say to me, like, you got to quit, like, rehashing and rehashing that. You got to think of the good memories and just, you know, put that, you know, try to put that behind you. And I'm thinking, I don't know how you do it, but difficult. It's been difficult for all these 40 some years.
By this point in the story, the 34-year-old admitted to double murder. Tom Callahan, he'd been taken into custody after calling the police on himself following the shooting of his wife, Kathy, and his mother-in-law, Elizabeth. And he was charged with two counts of murder, as the painful ripple effect of the lives he had taken continued to spread. The friends, family, and especially the children of Kathy and Elizabeth were struggling to make sense of what happened. Because this is the thing. One day everything is fine, and the next you're planning a double funeral. Even back in the 60s and 70s and 80s, this is always how it's been with domestic violence murders. And of course, Laura and her entire family attended the memorial services where she said goodbye to her aunt, Kathy, and Grandma Elizabeth.
They had open caskets, and that's clear as day as well. I don't know why parents force kids to go to like wakes and such, you know, when you're at that age, because I really think it's traumatizing, especially, you know, if you don't really understand death or anything.
Laura remembers saying goodbye to her grandmother.
My grandma looked really peaceful.
Laura recalls seeing how her Aunt Kathy looked, too.
I still clearly looked petrified, scared. Like, the look on her face was like, that's how it stayed. Like, they couldn't even change it.
Meanwhile, while Tom Callahan was in custody, police had been pressing him to explain his monstrous actions. And what do you know? He had an excuse. Shocker.
Okay, a little backstory. Supposedly he was in a car accident and hit his head, and the doctor put him on some kind of pain pills or some kind of medication. He claims that from the medication, he blacked out for those hours that this all took place. And then when he came to, he realized what he did.
Tom's story sounds like bullshit, and that's because it is. Let's face it, he's an abusive, controlling narcissist who could not stand to lose control over his wife, who he considered to be property. Slowly, Kathy was gaining her independence, which explains why the violence really ramped up when she got a job at JCPenney and asserted some control over her own life. And now, he's been caught. He's in jail, and like the coward that he is, he has to pretend he was blacked out when he killed these two people.
And later, Laura learned of several possible reasons that could have prompted a psychopath like Tom to kill his wife and mother-in-law. So according to stories that Laura had heard, Tom suspected Kathy of having an affair. And spoiler alert, she wasn't. However, she did have a strictly platonic male friend that she used to talk to, and Tom did not like that. Well, this male friend of Kathy's actually owned a clothing store, and a few months before the murders, the store's windows had been shot out with a gun. The police never found out who did it, but we can obviously all assume that it was Tom. And Tom became so paranoid that he actually had the phones tapped so he could listen to his wife's day-to-day conversations.
In the months that followed, Laura's family struggled to adjust to their new realities. Laura's three cousins had lost their mother in such a brutal way, and now their father was slated to stand trial for killing her and their grandmother, and he was expected to go to jail for a long time to pay for his crimes. So Laura's mother and father adopted all three of the children and raised them as their own, starting the very day of the murders.
The six of us, even to this day, are like extremely close. I can't even refer to them as cousins because from the time they came to live with us, my parents offered them to call them by aunt and uncle or mom and dad, and they opted to call them mom and dad. And they, to this day, they still call my parents mom and dad, and we call them our brothers and sisters.
Tom was facing two murder charges to which he pleaded not guilty, but it would take nearly 2 years for him to see the inside of a courtroom to stand trial.
Apparently, he had friends in the judicial system. So it took him like 2 years before he actually went to trial, which was like in, I think, 81. I do know that my mom and dad were there every day. I do know that my older cousin had to testify and my brother only to like establish times. I asked my parents if any domestic violence was brought up, but they said no, because at that time, domestic violence wasn't really a big thing.
Believe it or not, according to Laura, there was no testimony about the domestic violence in this trial. Tom's legal team attempted an insanity plea, which ultimately failed miserably and convinced no one on this jury.
So he was convicted of first-degree murder from my grandma, and he was sentenced to life in prison. He was sentenced for my aunt, 25 years, involuntary manslaughter because, and I'll never get this, because he didn't mean to kill her. He only meant to hurt her.
To repeat what Laura just stated, Tom was convicted of involuntary manslaughter for executing his wife, Kathy. That's total, total bullshit.
I don't get how they come about with sentence. I don't understand sentencing. So, yeah, that was his sentence. So at the time, of course, you know, I thought life was life.
Having this kind of domestic violence-related trauma materialize in the mind of a 13-year-old, no doubt has its implications.
The thing is not only does it impact that immediate family, you know, but the entire surrounding family. I mean, it affects so many people. It definitely changed my entire perspective of the world, life in general. Like, I never, ever thought of anything the same again after that. It made me real bitter against the world. I don't know why I stressed the whole world when it was only really one person. But it seemed as if ever since that happened, it gave me a sad reality of how cruel the world really is. It was a rude awakening.
And it's these reasons that compelled Laura to reach out and share her story with us.
I think hearing other people's stories just, you know, puts it in perspective for people, you know, about bringing awareness to things, domestic violence, like this can happen to you, you know, kind of thing. I'm at a point in my life where some changing needs done, and it's almost like I've been bitter against the world for far too long. And I think that this was a kind of an opening for me to make a change, you know, by talking to you and then progressing from there as far as, you know, getting over the hurt so much and moving, trying to move forward, which I really haven't done. I've been stuck in back in 1979 for 40 years.
And for those of you out there listening who perhaps have a story but have been hesitant, fearful, or reluctant to share it, time and time again, we hear from guests about how cathartic it can be to speak your truth about an experience. And Laura is using this experience with the First Degree as a demarcation line to move forward from, which we are very moved by and much appreciate and encourage.
But wait, this isn't over. Remember when Laura said that when she heard that Tom was sentenced to life for killing her grandmother, plus 25 years for killing her aunt? Well, she was under the impression that a life sentence would be, you know, a life sentence. But that wasn't exactly the case. So Tom has had the opportunity to be granted parole more than once already, and each time so far he's been denied. But that could change.
Come April 20th, he's up for parole release. He was denied. You think he's been up two or three times prior? And every time he's been up, our family writes letters.
Domestic violence is so prevalent that culturally it's been accepted as this unchangeable reality, which is insane that we're so desensitized to it all the time.
So let's share some stats with you, according to Kofi Annan, Secretary General of the UN. Declared in a report posted on the United Nations Development Fund for Women on the website, said that violence against women and girls is a problem of pandemic proportions. At least one out of every three women around the world has been beaten, coerced into sex, or otherwise abused in her lifetime, with the abuser usually someone known to her. According to the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence from October 2018, between 260,000 and 3 million instances of domestic violence are reported each year, while many, many, many other incidents go unreported. It's estimated that more than 10 million people experience domestic violence in the U.S. every year.
So whether or not Tom will ever be released is yet to be known. He shouldn't be, but that's beyond our control. The fact is that this domestic abuser received an involuntary manslaughter conviction and punishment for what is clearly a first-degree murder of his wife. It's very sickening and hard to understand. But it becomes easier to understand when you look at the unwavering prevalence of domestic violence murders in our society. It's a kind of murder that the public has been so used to hearing about because they happen so goddamn often and unabated. So Time magazine called domestic violence the pandemic within the pandemic. And police departments all over the country have reported an increase in crimes of domestic violence. 18% increase in San Antonio, a 22% increase in Portland, and a 10% increase in New York. And as the pandemic has dragged on, so too has this abuse. So now is as good a time as ever to take a look at domestic violence slayings. We need to acknowledge them, understand them, and figure out how to once and for fucking all stop them.
All right. Well, a huge thank you to Laura for being our First Degree for this episode. If you're listening out there and you think you have a story to tell, please email us hello@thefirstdegreepodcast.com. No story is too small to tell. You can follow us on Instagram @thefirstdegree, @AlexisLinkletter, @BillyJensen, @JackVanek. Join our Facebook group by searching The First Degree in the search bar. We are talking true crime all the time. And stick around because we're going to kill some time.
And remember, only you can prevent serial killers. And keep your friends close.
But not that,
close. Happy beer day.
Go get a beer.
Shout out to Jared Monaco for creating original music for The First Degree, our producing team, Caitlin Cleveland, Taylor Rogers, and Alan Santiago for Podcast One. Sources for this episode include court documents, ancestry.com, and our First Degree guest is always our largest source.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
All right. Well, welcome to yet another episode of Killing Time. And we kind of teased this a little bit in the actual episode, but Alexis made a little bit of a discovery while she was doing her interview for this week's episode. And I think it's really interesting because it made us all think about the concept of being a first degree and being one degree away from something. And for our podcast, we're obviously asking for these stories that are one degree away from a murder or another crime or something like that. But we don't realize that there can also be another first degree connection in addition to what we're actually looking for. So I'll kind of let Alexis explain that.
Right. And I think it's super interesting because Laura, who we had on today's episode, was a Maine super fan. And it's actually how she found out about the first degree. And at the end of the episode, which was a really emotional episode, if you guys heard the entire episode, which we just played for you, you know
that. They did.
Yeah, we hope so.
As opposed actually, to those people also, that fast forward cool. straight to Killing Time.
That's yeah. also cool. That's also cool. But, you know, it was an emotional interview. And at the end, she's like, hey, I have a little side note story for you. So we're going to play a little excerpt from that little story right now.
A little story or whatever. It's kind of like a first degree. So I don't know if Jack will remember me, but I have met her before. And
oh, how really? This
all, yes, and how this all came about was it was on one of the Warp tours. And it was when she first came out with her bracelets, because I actually still have three of them. I wore them all the time, but that was like 10 or so years ago, and I'm like 55 now, and I'm like, yeah, I don't know if I could wear these. But I still kept them, you know, I don't know, they're like sentimental to me. So when I met her, a friend of mine used to do merch for one of the bands. So I was hanging with him one day, and I was on the band's bus, and we had this little conversation, you know, I mean, she was so sweet, and, you know, I'm like thinking in my head, like, she's probably like, what is this mom doing on the bus? Like,
no, she's like, so nice.
Yeah. And, but anyway, the funny thing is we were talking and she was telling me how she had a crush on Jared.
No way.
Yes. And my daughter is 25. I have taken my daughter. I've probably seen the Maine at least 25 or 28 times.
No way.
I started taking her to all their concerts. And then I started listening to their music.
They're good.
That's how I found the first degree.
No way. Well, Jared's one of my closest friends. I love him so much.
If you say Laura and Erica, he'll know exactly from Ohio. He'll know exactly who you're talking about.
So this is so funny to me because I didn't know that I was going around telling people I had a crush on Jared back in the day. Like, I probably shouldn't have been doing that.
It's kind of nice for me to know this though.
Do you feel validated, Jared?
Yeah, because according to Jack, anytime you ask Jack about us knowing each other, like a long time ago, it's always, oh yeah, you were the one who was like obsessed with me.
That was true. But then I was also like, yeah, but like when I liked you, I also liked three other guys and I was making out with probably five other guys at the same time. So you weren't that special.
Oh, okay. Okay. Well, now least I have this golden proof.
Yeah.
That I can.
And you were going
me.
Around telling strangers that you had a crush on Jared.
I know. Like, why was I doing that? That probably wasn't the best thing to be doing.
Because you were in love with Jared.
I mean, in love is a stretch. But I can't believe I was doing that. That's so sweet that she remembered that.
And Jared, like, you remembered Laura and her daughter, didn't you?
Yeah. I mean, it's like, I'm really bad with like names and faces usually, but if you've been to enough shows, I know who you are. And they've been around for so long. We go back so far with them that, like, you know, it's like you kind of have this bond, especially with people that were there in the beginning of your band, you know? So very special place in our hearts for Laura and also for Erica, her daughter.
I was floored to hear she's been to almost 30 shows.
30?
30. Mm-hmm. She said 28, 29, 30. She's like somewhere around there for 100% because she started taking her daughter to shows when she was 15. And she's like, I still have my Jack Vanek bracelets. Like, I can't get rid of them. I'm so attached to them. You know, she's like diehard main fan along with her daughter. And I was just like, this is the best. And it's great when the First Degree concept really does come, you know, full circle where she had this close encounter with Jack and Jared as well. Several with Jared. But also the story that she's sharing with us, you know, bring attention to things like domestic violence, you know? So, and she also, it was really sweet just saying that she wants to use this experience, sharing her story on the First Degree as sort of like the first step in moving past all of it. And she's like, I've been holding on to this stuff for 40 years. I've been bitter about it and I'm ready to start feeling differently and to make changes. And this is going to be my first step. It was like very sweet to hear because that is the most we could ever hope for something. This is the most we could ever hope for our podcast. Like if someone tells their story and it has this cleansing therapeutic effect on them, I mean, that's the dream, right? So, you know, great conversation with Laura all around.
And haven't you said that about like a few of the guests that maybe haven't really talked about their story before or haven't been able to share it, that it is this like cathartic whole experience for them being able to, and especially kind of move the needle forward when it comes to like domestic violence and stuff like that?
Yeah, we've heard that several times over, and a lot of people have expressed that they feel this sort of therapeutic aspect from telling their story to, you know, a broad audience. And I think it really boils down to this idea of like being connected to a murder or to a crime or anything. I mean, it's painful, it's suffering. And I think finding meaning in it, you know, like I've said this quote several times, like Viktor Frankl's quote in Man's Search for Meaning is like, you find meaning in your suffering to get past it and to explain it and, you know, like philosophically come to terms with it. And I think a platform where you're educating people on your experience really does help you get there. So, you know, it was great to hear and we really, really enjoyed talking to Laura.
We love talking to Laura and Jared loves her.
Shout out to Laura. We love you, Laura.
The best part of that too is, sorry, now I'm going to switch gears back to like a happier conversation. But the best part about that is she has probably been with them through like they have these things, their eras in each of their albums where there's a different color. There's like a whole different theme. And then you come to the show with your friends and you all dress up in outfits and stuff. And I'm sure she's done all those things.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, like I said, we're talking like a decade of knowing somebody. Like, I mean, the pictures that you sent me, Lex, that were like to like
the pictures with you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like looking at myself back then, it's so funny. It was like the awkward phase. And it's like, that's how long we've known some of these people.
You're definitely out of that phase now, for sure.
Wow. I think he was freshly shaven.
Yeah. That's rare.
Right?
That's rare, yeah. You look great, Jared, then and now.
Well, what is everybody supposed to dress up on the Sticky Tour? Or is it called the Sticky Tour?
We don't have a name for it yet. We're still figuring it out. There's not.
So really everybody's like just supposed to bring bottles of maple syrup
of honey, and then throw and it on them on stage.
It's gonna be like a Guar show, but it'll be honey instead of blood.
And blood would work out with the red.
Ooh, yeah.
They'll probably make their fans dress in like red and yellow. That's the colors of the album, right?
Yeah, I mean, we'll see. We're gonna get creative with it. We're still. Trust me, there's 10 meetings a day to figure this out right now. So.
That's awesome.
They're like, what shade of yellow should we wear? And should it be fire engine red or...
I'm into it.
It's a whole thing. Okay, well, that was amazing because, I mean, I love... When you told us that, Alexis, Jared and I had a little moment. I was like, aww. I did have a crush on you.
I knew I was making a moment there. I was excited about it.
It was really sweet. So thank you. Thank you for that.
Really needed that. Thank you.
Yeah. Jared needed it. Okay. Well, while Jared's here, we're going to jump into like a question or two from the Facebook group, but I wanted Jared to stay here because one of the questions that somebody asked us was if any of us have ever had like a UFO or an alien or a ghost experience. And Jared and I actually had one together that he's going to tell you about.
I'm ready for this.
Okay.
Okay. So it was the first time Jack came out. This is after we were like technically dating.
No.
Like right before we started dating.
No.
Jack still wouldn't commit to you?
No, I wouldn't commit to it. This was like 2 months after we started talking and Jared's like, come see me on Warped Tour. And I was like, maybe. So that was that.
She flew all the way to Florida to see me. I don't know what you would call
it. Jack's so trying to play cool, but she flew to Florida.
You bought me a ticket. It's I didn't
irrelevant.
Buy my own.
It's irrelevant. It doesn't matter. So... I wanted to get a hotel so I could take a proper shower because we were on Warped Tour. So I booked a hotel, and then after the day was over, we were like hanging out drinking at the like festival grounds. And then like later that night, we walked to a Wawa to grab some food.
Tasty sandwich.
Such a move. And then on the walk from the Wawa to the hotel, something ran across like the road, and it was it wasn't a frog. It wasn't a...
It was in the shape of a tiny, tiny person, like a foot tall, but it had frog-like skin, and it was running across the road on two legs.
We both saw it.
That was very, like, slimy and alien-like and was about 10 inches tall.
What if it was an alligator?
That's not what an alligator looks like at all, Alexis.
No, no chance. No chance.
Okay.
What if
I think it's a lot more likely to be a 10-foot tall...
Amphibian or lizard.
10-inch tall amphibian or lizard than like a tiny person.
Its skin was sleek.
You guys saw the same thing?
Yes. It was shocking. We both at the same time were like, what the fuck was that? It was tiny.
It was tiny. It almost looked like a human shape, but had like green glistening skin, no scales, no amphibian face. It was like
human
a
face?
I didn't see the face because it was dark, but like it didn't have a snout of a alligator.
No idea.
So nope. Is this an alien or a ghost?
Like a basilisk lizard?
I don't know what that is.
Do a search for basilisk lizard.
I'll do it afterwards. But yeah, this is an alien. This is not a ghost because
Or do a search for an alien, but just type in all those keywords and see if anybody else saw it as well.
Okay, in Florida.
I'm going to go for a lizard. So
wait,
your so alien
is it a ghost or
Wawa.
An alien?
It's an alien.
Okay. Me and Alexis went to Wawa, actually, when we were in Florida.
I love Wawa.
Wawa has the best sandwich ever. I mean...
I don't know what we got there. We've been to so many roadside, like...
But Wawa, it really stands out in their sandwich making.
For a gas station, they really throw down.
I think it's better. It might be better than, like, a Jersey Mike's, in my opinion. Yeah, so we saw a miniature alien. What about you guys? Have you ever seen a UFO or had a ghost-like experience?
Nope.
Billy?
Never.
Never?
Never.
I grew up was so scary that believing in ghosts wasn't an option.
Mm.
Like, I grew up in a 200-something-year-old house in the woods, really isolated, big, old, abandoned basements and attics. And I couldn't believe in ghosts because I couldn't function.
Allow yourself to.
Yeah, because it was – and I was there alone all the time, and it was just like – you could not do that or you would die of fear. So I just never believed in them.
Or you would like welcome them into your heart.
Exactly.
Billy, no ghosts at all?
No ghosts. No.
No. I mean,
you hear bumps in the night, but then, you know, it's probably just a lizard running on 2 feet.
I swear.
Lizard.
I would, you know what? I wouldn't have thought it was an alien if Jared didn't see the exact same thing as me.
It was crazy. I'm not kidding, guys. It was nuts.
It was.
Well, aliens are real. We just don't know if they look like how they're personified in, exactly. in movies and stuff. But there's no yeah. doubt that there's other life.
But like that's they're like the grays. But this one was, it was green.
There have been only a couple moments in my life where I've been speechless. That was definitely one of them. I had no idea what I was looking at.
I'm jealous. I haven't even had like the feeling that someone, there's a ghost in there. Like I haven't even had an eerie sort of, ooh, a cold chill I can't explain. Like I've never had anything.
Mm.
Like I just live in the truth in science. It's boring.
Just live in the truth.
Ugh.
Okay, next. Well, I'll do one more question because we have a couple minutes. What is the weirdest thing that you guys have ever eaten? Have you ever eaten some crazy thing in a different country or just, you know, a crazy American food?
I've eaten all the weird stuff that like America has. Like I've eaten like alligator, mm-hmm. rattlesnake.
We had an alligator together, I think, Alexis, in New Orleans.
Oh, yeah, in New Orleans. And then I had frog legs. I've had blood sausage in Europe, which is so gross.
Ew.
Yeah. Escargot. Nothing like crazy, crazy, but certainly like the more exotic meats that are kind of accepted.
Mm. Billy?
Yeah, seriously. I'm totally vanilla when it comes to this.
Yeah, Billy doesn't even eat like...
Oh, yeah. Billy doesn't even eat sushi.
He doesn't even...
No, I'm warming up to sushi a little bit just in time for watching that documentary that says how much plastic
I'm
is
I'm not
in
watching
fish.
That.
But there's a credit card worth of plastic in these fish. I'm like, I'm not watching great. That.
No.
I finally got
it's like
into
one
sushi.
Of my it's like one of my only like, true joys. And like, Jack, I saw you're back on the sugarfish train. Like,
no.
Like,
I'm not. I'm not. I decided you tried against it. It wasn't.
God damn it.
Nope. Wasn't for me. But I am on the sushi train. And it's one of the only things that does bring me happiness in life. Yeah.
So I'm not watching that movie under any circumstances.
We refuse. I've eaten a scorpion on a stick in Ooh, China.
Scorpion's good.
That was probably not.
I don't know that, but sounds
Wait, was
like
it,
a lobster.
What type of scorpion was it? Was it like a big, like giant black scorpion or was
big
it?
Big ones. Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Were they tasty?
The meaty kind.
I was very drunk, so I don't remember really. That's I can't imagine it being that bad. I mean,
crunchy.
Yeah, crunchy. Probably just tastes like a crunch.
I've eaten one of those tequila worms at the bottom of the bottle.
The little glow worm.
Don't remember what it tastes like.
That's what I'm saying. That's what I'm saying. You're always drunk when this is happening. But that's like, yeah, at the bottom of the tequila, it probably just tastes like tequila.
That's right.
An extra little surprise. All right. Well, I feel like we've killed enough time.
We have. We've killed 15 minutes and 23 seconds of time. Beep, beep.
Beep, beep.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.